Cicero, orator, politician, and philosopher.
And Cicero was not only probably one of the greatest orators who ever lived, he was also a very clever philosopher. And it's thanks to Cicero that a lot of Greek philosophy has come down to us. And Cicero, it's no exaggeration to say, really rediscovery of his writings in the 15th century in Italy sparked the Renaissance, which led and shaped the development of the modern world.
That's novelist Robert Harris. We talk with him about the last book in his trilogy about the Roman statesman Cicero. It's called Dictator. Then we talk with economist James Galbraith about the controversy over Senator Bernie Sanders' economic plan that erupted when four past chairs of the Council of Economic Advisers attacked it.
To my mind, this was an exercise in professional bad behavior, in rank pulling, essentially, especially when the letter made a big deal of how important it was to apply rigor and objectivity to economic analysis. So I wrote a response to the four former chairs, saying that in particular I shared their admiration for rigor and objectivity, and when I read their letter I looked for their own rigorous analysis of the Sanders paper and discovered they hadn't done any at all.
We also look back to the late Quentin Young, who passed away this week. We play a clip from an interview I did with him in 2009. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Robert Harris's acclaimed historical novels are written with a keen eye toward the lessons we can derive from history for our own time. In 2014, he came onto Writer's Voice to discuss his book about the Dreyfus case, An Officer and a Spy. That book was an interlude in Harris's 12-year project to write a trilogy about the life of the great Roman statesman and orator Cicero. The first two books in the trilogy are Imperium and Conspirata. In late 2015, Harris came out with the final volume, Dictator. The trilogy has been called the finest fictional treatment of ancient Rome in the English language. Dictator takes place during a time of great civil unrest, when the Roman Republic was giving way to the rule of the emperors. Cicero was a constitutionalist who was deeply committed to democracy. He was a former elected consul or leader of Rome. But in his last years, his political ambitions were stymied by the growing power of Julius Caesar, who became Rome's first emperor. It's this conflict between democracy and dictatorship that drives the action in Harris's novel. Roman democracy was only for free male citizens of Rome. It excluded slaves, women, and foreigners. But Harris's book Dictator is told through the eyes of a slave, Cicero's long-serving assistant, Tiro, who, as a historical person, actually did write a biography of Cicero, now lost. As both outsider and insider, the character Tiro allows the reader a fuller perspective of his master and his society. Robert Harris is the author of 10 novels, as well as screenplays, short stories, and nonfiction. He lives in the UK, and I spoke to him via Skype in January. Robert Harris, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Dictator is such a terrific book. It's the third in a trilogy about the great Roman statesman and orator Cicero. The other books are Imperium and Conspirata. Now, you've spent 12 years of your life on this trilogy. What is so compelling about this time?
Well, it works for me on all sorts of levels. I love going back to that period more than 2,000 years ago and trying to think myself into the heads of the characters and to inhabit the Roman Republic, which was such a terrifically exciting period in human history, and so such wonderful people and such extraordinary art and philosophy. So there's that. And I also think it's a great way of analysing our own time, because this was a functioning democracy, and the problems that it encountered you can see replicated in our world today. Not exactly, but a lot of them are there. So for me, there was a double benefit. It was very rich material, and it was so huge, I couldn't encompass the story in just one volume.
And I'm going to ask you more later about that functioning democracy, but first, introduce us to your main character here, Cicero. He lived from 106 to 43 BC. Especially for us Americans, I think we tend to know so much less than you Brits about Roman history. Give us the Cliff Notes version before we go more deeply into the story.
Cicero has been a great person to spend the last 12 years with. I mean, he was one of the most extraordinary human beings who ever existed. He was born, as you say, in 106 BC to a sort of well-to-do family, but not at all aristocratic, in Arpinum, which is the sort of central southern region of Italy, south of Rome. He was an outsider, in other words, a provincial. He was extremely clever. No one in his family had ever been a magistrate in the Roman Republic. But from an early age, he decided he wanted to achieve glory. He wasn't a military man in any way. He did the minimal national service, but he was highly intelligent, and he trained himself to be a brilliant speaker, and he set out to make his reputation in the law courts. And he was a specialist in defending people, which he would do without charging them, and in return for their support and votes at election time. And gradually he rose in the Roman political system, and at the age of 42, the youngest possible age, he was elected consul of Rome, the joint ruler of Rome. But he came to power at a time when the Roman Republic was beginning to collapse. And my novel tell the story of Cicero in three parts, really. Part one, Imperium, is the rise of power. Part two, Conspirata, is being in power. And Dictator is the consequences of power, the repercussions. And he was an eyewitness to all the great events that even people who don't know much about Roman history are conscious of. The Civil War, the assassination of Julius Caesar. And Cicero was not only probably one of the greatest orators who ever lived, he was also a very clever philosopher. And it's thanks to Cicero that a lot of Greek philosophy has come down to us. And Cicero, it's no exaggeration to say, really, rediscovery of his writings in the 15th century in Italy sparked the Renaissance, which led and shaped the development of the modern world. So Cicero is a great unsung hero in world history, and I wanted to set out to bring him alive.
And an even more unsung hero in some senses is the narrator of this book, Tiro, who is Cicero's amanuensis, his right-hand man, and slave until Cicero freed him. Tell us a little bit about Tiro.
Well, Tiro is a very interesting character in his own right. I mean, he was an actual historical figure. He long outlived Cicero and lived, according to ancient sources, until he was nearly 100. He was at Cicero's side throughout his political career. There are letters from Cicero to Tiro. He was his secretary, but a bit more than that. He was a friend. He moved from between Cicero's home, so he knew all Cicero's family, to the law courts, to the Senate. He developed a system of shorthand, which was still in use hundreds of years later. And some of the symbols, which we still use today, were abbreviations, were invented by Tiro to take down Cicero's speeches. And he's just a perfect device, really, for a novelist, because he observes the genius at work. He's skeptical, but he's loyal. He's like a camera, really, lowered into this incredibly tumultuous time in politics. And he's at Cicero's side, and yet he's observing. And Tiro did, in fact, write a three-volume life of Cicero, which was published after Cicero's death, but which has disappeared with time. And so really, I'm reconstituting it in this trilogy of novels.
Did you feel that you were in some sense channeling Tiro, or how did you get his voice? What's your relationship to him as a character?
Well, I've always been fascinated by history and politics and people who really go for power without really probably having the nerve or the lunacy to want to do it myself. And so an earlier novel of mine, The Ghost, The Ghost Writer, as I think it's called in America, which was about an ex-British prime minister. He had a ghostwriter, and the novel is told from the ghostwriter's point of view. And really the Cicero trilogy told from Tiro's point of view is similar. It's that idea of being fascinated by politics and seeing the people playing the game, and yet at the same time being slightly sceptical and distant from it. So I didn't find it hard to inhabit Tiro's head because in a way I suppose I'm a bit like him. I couldn't have done what Cicero did, but I am admiring of it and yet also sceptical of all the compromises and all the treachery of politics, both in the Roman Republic and today.
Yes, that's for sure. Now, what was it like to be a slave of Tiro's stature or station?
You know, you have to think about slavery then. It came in all shapes and sizes, really. If you were a slave in the countryside or in the mines, then it was hell, and your life expectancy was very short. It was brutal. If you were a household slave, particularly if you were an educated slave like Tiro, who knew Greek and was a secretary, then I think life was pretty good. And by and large, you were freed, if not during your master's lifetime, then probably on his death. And then your children would be full Roman citizens. You wouldn't be yourself, but your children would be. And this is one of the explanations for the dynamism and success of ancient Rome. A little like America, it was a land for the ambitious immigrant. And it was a land of law rather than race. And so you could rise if you were intelligent and you got the right lucky breaks. And a character like Tiro was freed, and he would have become reasonably wealthy, and his family would have been fairly well established. As I say, if you didn't have that good fortune, then life was very brutal and short.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Robert Harris about his latest and last, a third in the trilogy about the great Roman statesman and orator Cicero. It's called Dictator. The first two in the series are Imperium and Conspirata. So Dictator refers to Julius Caesar, and this book really talks about both the last 15 years of Cicero's life as well as the last years of the Republic before the transition from a Republic to an empire, I guess you would say. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. You know, the Roman Republic really came to an end in 49 BC when Caesar crossed the Rubicon and invaded Italy from Gaul, and the Senate took to its heels. And not long after that, Caesar declared himself dictator and he won the civil war, and thereafter Rome became an empire. But up until 49 BC, you know, the rulers of Rome, at least technically, were elected by the people.
So how was the Republic? I mean, how democratic was Roman democracy?
Well, you know, of course it wasn't a democracy as we would know it, in that the slaves couldn't vote, women couldn't vote, people who had no property couldn't vote, and the electoral system was weighted in the interests of the wealthy. But having put those caveats in, it was an extraordinary democracy. The elections were annual. There were elections for the two men who divided power and ran Rome each year, the consuls, and then for the eight praetors, as they were called, the judges, magistrates who administered justice beneath them. And then there would be 20 new senators elected each year. There would be the people who ran Rome, the people who ran the aqueducts, the people who ran the roads, and also 10 tribunes who represented the people. And all laws in ancient Rome, every single law had to be voted on by the people in the forum or in some other public place. So you saw your rulers all the time and you got to vote on their legislation and you heard them speak. And in many ways, it was a much more vibrant democracy than the ones we live in today. And at the time when Cicero became consul, the theoretical electorate of the Republic was 1 million citizens. Not all of them voted, obviously, the vast majority didn't, because you had to be present on the day in Rome to vote. But still, there in embryo is an astonishing exercise in democracy, which in the course of my novel Dictator vanishes from the earth and is not seen again for 1700 years. I mean, not really until the founding fathers and the changes in my country, in Britain, at the beginning of the 19th century, do you have anything like that power of the people again. And that's really part of what Dictator is about. Why did this extraordinary advanced system of political control collapse and fail and disappear from the earth?
Well, it almost seems like the first chink in the armor was one that we may be very familiar with here, and that was Caesar's military adventurism, where he went around conquering different lands, quite brutally, we might add, without the vote of the Senate. Isn't that right?
Yes, I mean, you know, it's a huge topic to this day academically, what happened to the Roman Republic. But broadly speaking, there are many reasons why the Roman Republic came to an end. For instance, it was a city-state to begin with, and the democratic structure, which by Cicero's time had been in existence for 500 years, that was fine for handling a city-state, couldn't cope with what had become an empire. You know, the founding fathers, as it were, of the Roman Republic had never envisaged ancient Rome becoming what was the equivalent at the time of a global superpower. And you had these enormous areas now under Roman control. Pompey the Great, who's a figure in my novel sequence, has captured a lot of the eastern Mediterranean and Spain. And Caesar has conquered modern France and Belgium and the Low Countries. And this is flooding money into Rome. And from these sources, from Pompey's conquests in the east and from Caesar's in the west, Rome at election time every summer was flooded with money. Elections were bought. Almost everyone who was elected was challenged for corruption. The whole of the political system entered gridlock and sank into complete disuse. And when numerous attempts at what we would now call campaign finance reform, they never really worked. And so the system fell into discredit and became paralyzed. The other problem was that is described in the three novels is because of external threats, the old checks and balances on power about the limited military commands and limited periods in office were suspended. And men started to get what used to be single-year commands were extended to 5 years. And they were given unparalleled powers. And the democracy began to buckle, and then eventually it collapsed. And Cicero, my hero, who's a great believer in the Republic, in the Constitution, is one of the last men left standing, defending the idea of democracy.
But he still faces, it seems, the dilemma. At a certain point in the book, I think he resolves it, but he faces a dilemma. You start the book out, actually, Robert Harris, you start this book out with Cicero being exiled from Rome as a result of the Catiline conspiracy, which maybe you can briefly tell us what that was. He does get back to Rome, but he seems pretty Machiavellian and conniving, almost corrupt himself, willing to twist the law for his own designs. But then he changes. So talk a little bit about the trajectory he makes. He seems to become more ethical as the book goes on.
I think that's true. The Catiline conspiracy, which is described in Conspirata, having in the first volume, Imperium, Cicero becomes consul. No sooner has he become consul than he finds he faces a serious conspiracy to try and take over the state. He ends up fighting that, but only by having five conspirators put to death with the sanction of the Senate, But it hung over him for the remainder of his political career that he was a sort of tool of the state who had illegally put to death citizens. And the opening of this novel, Dictator, he's paid the price for that and has been sent into exile, partly at the request of Caesar, who always saw in Cicero a threat to his own position. So Cicero is banished, but Cicero doesn't want to be a sort of dead hero. He wants to come back. And a lot of the novel, the first half at any rate, describes the twists and turns by which Cicero, a professional politician, manages to convince both sides he's supporting them and survives. I see him, he's like a cat, you know, walking through a minefield. He steps aside gingerly to avoid each explosion, and somehow he remains intact. But even he can't, in the end, manage this balancing act once the civil war begins between Caesar and Pompey. He has to choose. In the course of this novel, I think Cicero becomes a much more heroic and a much more noble figure. He's shut out from power. His family disintegrates. He suffers a lot of personal reverses. He's forced really out of politics and can only turn to philosophy. And amazingly, the philosophy changes him and gives him the strength to, in the end, after Caesar's assassination, to make one last stand for democratic ideals. And all this is true. And I think that Cicero emerges at the end as a noble and tragic figure. And part of my intention in these books was to try and restore Cicero to popular culture. And he's eliminated almost from Shakespeare, from Julius Caesar. He's given about six lines. He's never really been a figure that's been taken up in novels or films. And yet, you know, he's a curiously modern figure and very sympathetic. He's very like us. He's compassionate. He hated bloodshed, didn't even like to see the games, you know, the animals fighting one another. He was squeamish. He was compassionate and rather forward-thinking in his views. And in that way, I find him a very sympathetic figure to write about.
I so agree. I think you did a terrific job. I think you really succeeded at this, so much so that I actually looked up one of the books that he wrote when he kind of, you know, took refuge into philosophy before the final struggle after Caesar's assassination. And that was, I think it's called the Tusculum Disputations. I found it really interesting reading and quite modern, as you say.
Yes. I mean, you know, what you've got to bear in mind is that what Cicero set out to do in a very practical Roman way was to take Greek philosophy and to convert it into something which would be of everyday use for people. And what he set out to do at this time of huge upheaval, when thousands of men were dying, or people were starving, the whole of the known world had been turned upside down, he consciously stated that his aim was to remove from men the fear of death. He set out to say, why should we be frightened of it? What is the best way to live? What is a good life? By which he didn't mean a luxurious life. He meant a good life, morally good. And what was a good death, a morally good death? And if you could find the key to those two things, you could find a way through to a kind of immortality, even if, and he didn't pretend to know, even if there was no afterlife. And it's very much a bridge between Greek philosophy and what was a few decades later to become the Christian faith. It's a sort of belief in a kind of basic human decency that we should try and get to. And the Tusculan Disputation stands up very well today as philosophy. And there is something really heroic, I think, about the way that men like Cicero, without any kind of belief in a hereafter, set out to try and find a philosophy which would enable us to cope with being alive. And he really lived by it at the end of his life and tried to stand up for it. And I do find there's something terrifically heroic about him at the end of the novel.
Well, it is a terrific novel, Robert Harris. It's a very moving story. Are you working on anything else?
Yes, I've just started writing a new novel, which if I can, I'm going to try and have done by the summer, and which hopefully may be published by Knopf in the States in the fall.
Is it another historical, political history?
No, not really. It's set in the present day, but it has a sort of overhang from the past. I mean, I do find there's such rich material in history, and it's the way history and the modern day and fiction and reality collide. It's in that sort of intersection that I find is my patch that I like to write about.
Yes. Well, this is just really terrific. And thanks so much for telling us about Cicero and for writing this wonderful book, Dictator.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You can read an excerpt from Dictator by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the kerfuffle over Bernie Sanders' economic plan. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Several weeks ago, I interviewed economist Gerald Friedman for this show about his analysis of Bernie Sanders' economic plan. That was before the New York Times published a scathing denunciation of Friedman's analysis, claiming that 7 so-called left-leaning economists questioned its validity. It turns out that none of the economists are particularly left-leaning. Austin Goolsbee, who was one of them, is a free market advocate, and another wasn't even an economist, but just a pundit. 4 of the economists were former chairs of the Council of Economic Advisers. The backlash was swift from other prominent economists like Dean Baker, Thomas Piketty, and my guest, James K. Galbraith. Galbraith was at one time the executive director of the Joint Economic Committee, the parallel congressional group to the President's Council of Economic Advisers. He wrote an open letter to the 4 former chairs in a scathing rebuttal of their criticisms, which he followed up with a post in the Boston Globe titled "The Kerfuffle Over Sanders' Economic Plan." I called Galbraith up to tell us what the kerfuffle is all about.
Well, Senator Sanders has been presenting across the country a very comprehensive program of basic structural reforms to American economy and society, which include a single-payer universal health care system, tuition-free access to public universities, and a major program of investment in infrastructure, among other things. And what happened was that an independent academic observer, Professor Gerald Friedman, the University of Massachusetts, decided to write a paper assessing the economic growth implications of this program. And what Professor Friedman did was to take the scale of the Sanders program and run it through a model which incorporated some very longstanding and quite conventional assumptions about the effect of an economic expansion program. And it came out with some consequences for the path of real gross domestic product, real output. And he reported that. And that path was showed a very strong effect. It showed growth of over 5% for a decade. And what then happened was that a group of senior high public officials, past chairs of the Council of Economic Advisers under Presidents Clinton and Obama, issued a short letter denouncing the paper as an open letter to Senator Sanders and an open letter to Professor Friedman on the ground that these forecasts were per se implausible. They offered no evidence for their proposition beyond the fact that the growth rate of the U.S. economy hasn't been that high for quite some time. The last time it was at 5% for even 3 years in a row was the early 1980s, and they didn't even mention that. So their claim was based simply on a comparison of those projections with the past historical record. And in addition, they were relying basically for public media impact on their prestige, the fact that they were well known to the public, that they'd held this high office in the past. And to my mind, this was an exercise in professional bad behavior, in rank pulling, essentially, especially when the letter made a big deal of how important it was to apply rigor and objectivity to economic analysis. So I wrote a response to the four former chairs, saying that, in particular, I shared their admiration for rigor and objectivity. And when I read their letter, I looked for their own rigorous analysis of the Sanders paper and discovered they hadn't done any at all. And that, of course, started a long discussion, which has now proceeded through a number of different articles. So ultimately, one of the former chairs, Christina Romer, and her husband David, a fellow economist, did produce a document which stated what their criticism of the Sanders paper was. They, I think, to some degree misrepresented the nature of that criticism and continued to maintain that it's a matter of logic or a matter of math, and it's certainly been reported, was reported in the New York Times as a question of mathematics. So we're now at a stage where we are discussing what the question actually is, and it's clearly not a question of mathematics. It's a question of underlying economic theory. So that gets to your question. What is the issue that's at stake? The issue that appears to be at stake is whether a large-scale growth program will have enduring large-scale effects or enduring effects of any kind. And the position which has been articulated by the professors Romer is a very interesting one. It is that an economic expansion program, no matter how large scale, only works in the short term and has no effects after 5 or 6 years. If it's a relatively short term program, the effects fade out because the economy returns, regardless of whether there is a government program or not, to the path that it would have taken anyway. So it's an interesting fact that Christina Romer, who was an advocate, much to her credit, of a very large stimulus package in 2009, believes that as of today, the stimulus package that was enacted, or the larger one that she advocated, would have made no difference to the current state of the economy, no difference at all. That there are no enduring or cumulative effects to having a government program, at least to the level of GDP. Obviously, you build infrastructure, it's still there, but it's not making a contribution currently to total spending and output. Or if you take that same position and you apply it to the great events of the 20th century, the same position holds that the New Deal and World War II made no difference to the path of the economy as of the 1950s, that the recovery from the Depression would have been exactly the same, certainly by 1960, as it was, even if there had not been a New Deal and if there had not been a war. And that's a position which I think very few people can hold with a straight face, unless they are deeply devoted to a particular type of economic model, which has an underlying growth path to the economy built into it. And Professor Friedman and I are not advocates of that model. And in the 1930s, when it really mattered, John Maynard Keynes and his followers were not advocates of that kind of model either. It was their belief that when you had a deep economic depression, that the effects of a strong program of expenditures financed by loans was to bring the economy out of its unemployment equilibrium on a sustained basis. And it's certainly the belief of my belief as someone who's taken a look at the economic history, that the New Deal and World War II did have that effect and had an enduring effect on the prosperity I grew up with in the 1950s, 1960s, and into the 1970s. And that was built in part upon the fact that the New Deal transformed the finances of American households who had no assets in the 1930s, but by the 1950s, thanks to the New Deal and the programs that financed the war, American households were solidly middle class in their whole ability to own houses and their ability to their creditworthiness, their ability to attract mortgages, and their ability to finance a middle class standard of living. And so I also believe that the recovery program of 2009, along with the automatic stabilizers that are built into the law in Social Security and disability insurance and unemployment insurance and food stamps and other programs, do in fact have lasting effects by preventing destitution and in the case of employment programs, by providing people with employment histories and incomes, they have the effect of creating a level of enduring prosperity which would not otherwise be obtainable. And that's the reason you do them. It's not simply to stimulate the economy and fill in a gap which happens to be present for a short period of time, but it is something which has permanent, structural, and enduring effects. I think that's a reasonable position, and that's the position I hold and that Professor Friedman holds.
Oh, could I ask you a question about this? Because it seems that there's also a policy of the New Deal that's not being talked about a whole lot here, and that is the role of supporting unions, because many people point to the fact that, or they point to the idea that a strong union movement in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was able to, in fact, you know, preserve the kinds of gains, stimulatory gains that boosted incomes. So I just wonder, and that's a political economic kind of intervention, let's say. So in a time when the unions are so weak, would the stimulatory effect also be strong? I mean, in other words, would it be able to raise wages?
Well, I think you're pointing to one of the most important institutional changes that occurred in the New Deal, which was the rise of a powerful industrial union movement. And that, as you say correctly, continued to have effects on the living standard and therefore the purchasing power of working-class American households for many decades afterwards, and in fact still today. Although obviously since the 1980s, the union movement has been under siege. It's still an institutional and structural feature that wasn't there in the 1920s. So that's a very important. I think it's also important to note that there are, you know, there are permanent institutions which provide the underpinning of economic activity that were created in the New Deal. The New Deal was a vast project of national construction. It rebuilt every rural schoolhouse in the country. It built 1,000 airfields, about 700,000 miles of roads that didn't exist before or were not paved. The Tennessee Valley Authority, which the rural electrification, which brought the basic infrastructure of development to the South for the first time, a part of the country which had been deeply impoverished ever since the Civil War. So all of these things are permanent structural effects. Unionization is a particularly important one. Could that effect have assisted in the present era? I think the answer to that is it did. When you build up public programs and when you support, let's say, expenditure on schools and hospitals and of state and local governments, you support public employees and service employees, which have been the fastest growing part of the labor union movement. So, indeed, the same effects are going to be present today. Now, these things are not going to show up in a model which assumes that the economy grows at a natural rate and that it doesn't deviate from that rate except temporarily. But they are, in fact, in any reasonable construction of the real world, an important phenomenon. Their presence should be taken account of in the way we think about economic growth and development.
We're talking with economist James K. Galbraith about the article he wrote in the Boston Globe, The Kerfuffle Over Sanders' Economic Plan. It's a rebuttal to four former chairs of the Council of Economic Advisers who criticized an analysis of Sanders' plan by economist Gerald Friedman. We spoke to Friedman several weeks ago on this program. Following up on Galbraith's last point, I pointed out that in economics, sometimes the assumptions of economic theory seem pretty abstract.
Well, this is necessary in economics. The economy is a complex phenomenon. In order to try and convey its basic properties to the policy world and to the public, you have to make assumptions, you have to build models. But what happened here was a group of economists who had themselves a model that does not withstand scrutiny, certainly by sensible people, asserting that their model was embodied logic and correct math, and that any deviation from that model was an error, was a mistake. And they were able to get away with it for a short period of time because they were very well-known, prestigious people. And the media naturally assumed that they were speaking with authority. And they had the backing of powerful voices at the New York Times. So that was a real challenge, in fact, to those of us who feel differently, to speak up and say, look, no, a bit of examination here would convince a great many people that the underlying model that was being advocated, even though it has a lot of position in academic economics departments, is not a sensible model at all. Now, one of the questions I asked in one of my pieces was, does one suppose that President Obama, who was the architect of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and its chief political advocate, and the enactment of that bill was one of his great political triumphs, do you suppose he thinks that it had no enduring effects 5 years, 6 years into his administration? I would be astonished if he thinks that, and I would be surprised if he even realized that that was the strongly held theoretical position of the economic advisor he was relying on at the time. I'm not saying this to disparage Christina Romer, who advocated for a strong program. I crossed paths with her once at testimony and before the Senate, and I was on my way in, she was on her way out, and she sort of encouraged me to go hard and heavy at the to advocating a big program. So we were definitely on the same side. But the fact is that when you evaluate these things after the fact, the model that she's using just isn't a plausible model, and a sensible person looking at it with fresh eyes isn't going to accept it.
Well, there have been also other criticisms of the model, and she may have shared in this as well. Coming down to the idea that we are already at full employment, I wanted to ask you about this because just this past week, a new jobs report came out. It was treated as being quite rosy. And then I heard another economist say that those employment numbers are highly misleading because they don't take into effect huge numbers of discouraged workers who have stopped looking for work, nor the also enormous numbers of workers who cannot get full employment. That it's, you know, they're underemployed. So I wonder if you could talk about this whole controversy over the Sanders program with respect to jobs and, you know, the criticism that we're at full employment, so there's no more room for more jobs.
Well, let's first of all stipulate that the Sanders program would in fact produce strong economic growth and therefore strong demand for labor. The Romers argued that under that stipulation, inflation would soar. That's the phrase they used to wrap up their critique of the Friedman program. They didn't offer any real evidence for that, but one has to, I suppose, infer that what they're thinking is that we would breach some kind of full capacity limit of the economy, and that that would then cause wages and prices to get out of hand. And the reality, of course, is that that's an assertion for which there is no supporting evidence whatsoever, and in which there's significant recent experience in the late 1990s when we did, in fact, enjoy full employment with practically no increase of inflation. So I'm wondering what kind of inflation model they have, they're thinking about, and again suspect that they are relying on rules of thumb that have been out of date for a century rather than anything that resembles an actual analysis. Mm. Now, what is the situation in the labor market? It is true. The unemployment rate is down, but it is down mainly in large part because a very large number of people are no longer looking for work. And the ratio of employment to population has hardly improved since the crisis in 2008. About half of the people who have dropped out of the labor force are above the age of 62 when they can get early retirement on Social Security. That's my understanding anyway. And, you know, the rest are simply likely people who have become discouraged and are doing other things. So, what will happen if there is a strong demand for labor? Well, in the first place, many of those who are discouraged will come back into the labor force. That already happened last month with the 200 and some thousand new jobs created, the unemployment rate went up because more people came into the labor market looking for work. So it's clearly part of the consequence of strong labor demand is that people come back, the jobs are available, they say, okay, well, maybe I'll start looking. Second thing that will happen is that people who are taking early retirement will consider coming off of early retirement and going back to work. So there's a reserve of labor available there. The third thing that will happen is that wages will rise, which is not a bad thing. Wages have not risen for decades, and at least median wages have not. So if the wages across the whole spectrum of American workforce started going up, this would be very good for living standards, not bad. Fourth thing that would happen is that businesses, if they actually were faced with a shortage of labor, would become more aggressive about substituting technology capital for labor. So in all of these ways, there are elastic, the economy is quite elastic with respect to demand for labor. The Sanders program isn't on the same scale as the mobilization for World War II, where the total demand was doubled in the space of about 3 years. Total scale of the economy was doubled. At the start of World War II, or rather just a bit before it started, the unemployment rate was 17%. And you could not have calculated that if you thought 17% was a hard limit, you couldn't possibly have thought that 17% of unemployed people would permit the whole scale of the economy to double, particularly not if 11 or 12 million of them were going to be taken off to the armed forces and put in uniform and sent to Europe, which is what happened. But in spite of that, and in spite of the shortage of manpower, frankly, of previously mostly young men who went into the armed forces, the economy found a labor reserve that was capable of doubling its total production in a very short period of time. We're not in that situation now, but that shows you that the kind of claim that's being made here, that there's some kind of hard and fast limit to productive capacity, and that we are near that limit after 7 years of anemic growth following a catastrophic crisis, is basically preposterous. It's basically it cannot be sustained as a serious argument, frankly.
Now, my final question is about deficit spending, because you know, Keynesian spending, the spending in the New Deal and afterwards was deficit spending. Sanders says he won't run a deficit, and in fact, the Friedman paper says that, you know, the deficit will be erased. Or no, actually, maybe he's talking about the balance of payments internationally. I'm a little confused on that, but to this issue, how do you stimulate without running a deficit? You know, how do you answer this whole issue?
Okay, 2 points. The first is that there is a positive effect of revenue on revenue when you produce a higher rate of economic growth. It's very clear. And to the extent that that higher rate of economic growth is supported by credit creation in the private sector, which is what happened in the 1990s, the growth of public revenue can be very rapid. That said, in present circumstances, it's my view that a properly designed policy will keep the United States government in deficit as an ordinary matter of course. And the reasons for that are First of all, that it is much better to run the economy at a balance of full employment than it is to run the government at budget balance. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the United States' position in the world, where we are supplying basically the financial asset that everybody uses, namely the reserve dollar, requires that we run a current account deficit. We import more than we export. And that will only be possible in a stable configuration, financial configuration, if the government is also spending more than it takes in taxes. So there's nothing particularly wrong with supplying financial assets to the world. It's, in fact, a major contribution to our living standard that we're able to do that. And it's a sign of the centrality of the U.S. to the world economy. But given that that is the position that we've been in actually for 40 years, since the early 1970s, just a sign of how backward understanding of basic economics is, that we're stuck in a political discourse which somehow thinks that the government's books should be balanced the way a small business books have to be balanced. So that's, I think, the essence of it. If I had to reproach the Sanders program for one thing, it would be that it does, in fact, pay a bit too much deference to these doctrines of fiscal balance. And I think that if, as time went on, they would discover that that's not plausible, it's not really the best position to take, they would have to modify it in order to adjust to reality. That's my position, not the position of the Sanders campaign. But, you know, you can argue on the other side that the Sanders operation has a degree of fiscal responsibility that a renegade economist like Galbraith doesn't adhere to. And I'm willing to live with that particular reputation.
So what is the argument when people say, oh, we are, destroying our children's future by loading them down with debt?
The United States government is presently paying on short-term borrowing 0.25%, and on long-term borrowings it's 3 or 4%. So there's just no argument here that there's something risky about lending to the United States government. The fact is, the world, whenever the danger threatens in the world, that's what the world investment community wants to do, is to lend to the United States government. They pull money out of other places and bring it here. So I think the best answer to this notion that there's something about a burden of the public debt is to look at the interest rate, which is available in the paper, and ask yourself, is that an interest rate that would be extended to a lender, to a borrower who was at risk? The answer to that question is clearly no. Mm. The other way to look at it is to say, okay, these bonds, if you can count them as a burden on the United States taxpayer, but they are equally an asset to those who hold the bonds, which are to a very large extent, on the one hand, government agencies, so that nets to zero, financial institutions, which are largely domestic, and then there are the foreign holders who are likely to keep holding those bonds and never cash them in, basically sitting pretty on their assets, but that's it doesn't bring them anything in the way of current benefit, and nothing much in the way of, it may bring them a certain measure of self-esteem and prestige, but one should not fall into the trap of believing that it brings them an enormous amount of real power, because we can always service those bonds. Their only obligation is to pay them out in United States dollars, which are completely under the control of the U.S. government. So all that said, I mean, it is possible for a government, and it has been the case of governments in many countries, to get into fiscal difficulty. But the government that is not going to get into fiscal difficulty and is not in fiscal difficulty now is the United States government. Mm-hmm. And the Sanders program is therefore entirely feasible as a matter of public finance.
Well, James Galbraith, I want to thank you so much for explaining the plan and your support for it, going beyond it as well, and also your biting critiques of those who have been taking it down. I mean, I personally have been shocked at Paul Krugman since he used to be one of my favorite economists. And he's been pretty stimulatory himself in the past, so I don't really know why he's taken the position.
Paul and I are old friends. We're allies on most things. This was not his finest hour, but I think we'll get past this now, and I hope go forward in a much more constructive spirit.
James K. Galbraith is an expert in income inequality and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and at the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. His latest book is the recently released Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and we'll be talking with him about that book later on in the season. You can find a link to his rebuttals of the critics of Gerald Friedman's analysis of Bernie Sanders' economic plan at writersvoice.net. You can also listen back to our interview with Gerald Friedman about his analysis. And now, a brief moment to remember an American hero in the field of public health. Dr. Quentin Young died on March 7th at the age of 92. He was a crusader for single payer and for the health of workers and the poor. His patients included Martin Luther King and Studs Terkel, and Barack Obama was a patient in his practice and a personal friend. I had the opportunity to interview Quentin Young in 2009, at the time Obamacare was being developed. We spoke about single payer and why he thought it was the only sensible design for providing universal health care. Here's a short clip from that interview. You have called single payer the only fiscally prudent proposal. Could you lay out some of the differences between the kind of plan that we have here and single payer?
I think I can. First of all, that's very accurate. Our view, we're proponents for single payer for some 20 years now, and up until quite recently we kept emphasizing it as the best plan. We now say it's the only plan because the system has gone so much in the depths of for-profit control, and for that reason we feel that the American experience with Medicare, which is very close to what we're emphasizing universally, should cinch the deal in the debate. So to speak about your state, which it's worth noting was the most well-positioned to try these marketplace-type solutions. By marketplace, I mean keeping the for-profit insurance companies in the mix. Our view is very categorical. We feel that they're not only the solution to any of these problems, they are the cause of the problems, and the evidence is overwhelming. It's a madness to run a health system on marketplace arrangements. There are obvious places where marketplace incentives can be good. My favorite example is the computer industry, which seems to be highly competitive and reducing costs, improving quality more or less each year or two. But that doesn't apply to health care.
Dr. Quentin Young, in an interview with me in 2009 for Sea Change Radio, a program I then co-hosted. He died March 7th at the age of 92. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview where he makes the argument that single payer essentially pays for itself. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.